Thank you, Kitty. Today's panel, I think, was titled, Can We Stop Global Warming Without Stopping the Global Economy? Fortunately, the New York Times called me last night to ask me what my panel was going to be about, so they wrote an editorial this morning called Global Warming and Your Wallet, and that's probably as good a title for this session as the one we had. Let me just briefly introduce the panel here, which is stellar from my perspective. Carol Browner is a principal of the Albright Group and a principal of the Albright Capital Management. In her current position, Carol provides strategic counsel in the critical areas of environmental protection, climate change, energy conservation, and security. Of course, we all know her as the administrator of EPA. She was the longest serving EPA administrator in the history of the agency. Dan Este is the Hill House Professor of Environmental Law and Policy at Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale Law School. He also directs Yale Center's Environmental Law and Policy and the Center for Business and Environment at Yale. His most recent book, Green and Gold, How Smart Companies Use Environmental Strategy to Innovate, Create Value, and Build Competitive Advantage will be at the Pepke Bookstore, and Dan will be there right after this session at 10:15 to sign the book. John Fund is a columnist for the Wall Street Journal and writes On the Trail, a column for the paper's opinionjournal.com. He's also a contributor to the 24-hour cable news channel CNBC and MSNBC. He's the author of several books, including Stealing Elections, How Voter Fraud Threatens Our Democracy, and Cleaning House, America's Campaign for Term Limits. Tom Lovejoy is president of the H. John Heinz III Center for Science, Economics, and Environment. Previously, before coming to the Heinz Center, Tom was at the World Bank. He was their chief biodiversity advisor and led a lead specialist for the environment for Latin America and the Caribbean, and a senior advisor to the president of the United Nations Foundation. He's also served as a science advisor to the U.S. Secretary of the Interior and as executive vice president for the World Wildlife Fund. Welcome. And Andrew Refkin on the far end has been an environment writer for the New York Times since 1995, traveling the Hudson Valley to the North Pole to report on conservation, climate change, and efforts to sustain the human adventure without wrecking the home planet. His prize-winning book, The Burning Season, chronicled the life of Chico Mendes, the slain Amazon activist, and his latest book, The North Pole Was Here, describes the Arctic journeys for readers of all ages, and it's quite a nice read. This panel, I think, is, if you haven't had the benefit of being in the energy track from the beginning of the Ideas Festival, is really a culmination of a lot of discussions, a lot of conversation about jobs versus the environment, employment versus the environment, the economy versus the environment. This is not a new kind of polarization of how we move forward as a society, as a civilization, in trying to address new problems like climate change. If you accept the science, there are different accounts of what these impacts will cost. But before we try to answer this riddle about whether it's your wallet or the climate, I want to take us back just a little bit. This notion, the issue, the wedge about economy versus the environment. Carol Browner, when did you first, as a U.S. administrator of EPA, encounter that as either a polemic or a political issue?
Well, it certainly has been an issue for some time, and I actually think it dates back to Bush 1. And as they were gearing up for re-election and thinking about the issues that they would confront, the economy certainly was facing some problems. And there was a growing anti-regulatory movement. Most of it was focused on the environmental regulations, although it was never characterized that way. It was characterized as just, you know, small businesses, the burden of government, it's too much, they're spending money needlessly. And we found our way into a debate that really was about choosing between a healthy environment and a healthy economy. I think it was Clinton in his campaign who really put those words together and, you know, put out the idea that we don't have to choose, that we can have both. And in many ways, they're linked. The healthier the environment, the more likely a healthy economy, and vice versa. As 8 years as a regulator running the EPA, we set some of the toughest environmental standards ever, air, water, waste. We enforced the laws, and at the same time, we were part of an administration that was able to grow the U.S. economy and to balance the budget. And so, you know, I, for one, don't believe we have to choose. I think that there are ways that we can confront the climate change challenge and still be mindful of our economy. That is not to say there won't be cost associated with reducing our carbon emissions. There will absolutely be costs. There will be winners and losers in the economy. Let me give one quick example. In 1990, the United States Congress decided to ban CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons. They actually did it in a law. It wasn't even a regulation. CFCs are used in refrigeration. It was a hotly contested debate on the floor of the United States Senate. At that time, I was Al Gore's legislative director when he was a senator. And we had very informed senators taking to the Senate floor to say things like, we won't have air conditioning in our cars. Life as we know it will change. There was not a substitute available. The technology didn't exist. There were companies looking at it. Once Congress said, it's over, it's done, on a date certain, you cannot sell CFCs, guess what happened? Lots of people invested the resources to find an alternative because they now had an opportunity to sell, a guaranteed opportunity in the marketplace. And so the final thing I will say, and I say this as a former regulator, a person who signed regulations virtually every month, and regulations that had dramatic consequences for sectors of the U.S. economy, I do believe that the government has a very important role to play in capping carbon emissions. I set up a cap and trade program for acid rain, which was very successful in driving down the cost of reducing acid rain. Having said that, I spent a lot of time thinking about this. I think the fairest and most efficient way forward when it comes to greenhouse gases is to look at taxing emissions, taxing the energy. We'll have to make adjustments in terms of how it impacts individuals and businesses, but I don't think at the end of the day a cap and trade program is going to get us the same kind of economic efficiencies that a tax will get us.
This is, as we mentioned, as I've said, the economic versus the environment question is not new, and you've kind of given us a history. But at that same time, it became a challenge, and many in the environmental community and in business and from government were trying to work on making it cleaner, smarter, and cheaper. Dan, you were a part of those discussions. Your new book seems to be also revisiting this question and casting it anew. Can we make it cleaner, cheaper, smarter, or is it only going to cost more?
So I think, you know, the research underlying this Green to Gold book, which is looking across hundreds of companies all around the world, suggests that Tom Friedman may be slightly wrong, for those who heard him last night, in saying there's no green revolution. It may not be a broad-based revolution yet, but there are certainly lots of business people who are coming to this issue of the environment with a new approach these days. This is no longer a fringe issue in the business world. It's not something that the typical person in this is no longer someone wearing Birkenstocks coming out of the hills of Vermont with some clever idea for wind power. It's now the biggest, toughest, hardest-nosed companies in America really seeing opportunities here, and I think that's a big change. And just to take one example, you know, Jeff Immelt has turned GE around. When I was at EPA, Jack Welch fought us every single day. Refused to think about cleaning up the Hudson and Housatonic Rivers. Jeff Immelt put those cases behind him and has now said, this company is going to be about green opportunities. High-efficiency locomotives, high-efficiency jet engines, taking the turbines out of those jet engines, building a wind power business, water power, clean coal technologies. It's an incredible story of turnaround. And I think you see other companies doing the same thing. So this is no longer fringe. It's mainstream. And businesses recognize that where society wants answers to problems like climate change, or frankly beyond that, water, too much chemicals in their food, those that provide solutions will have big market opportunities. And I do think that's a change, and frankly, it's something we should be excited about. It represents, in my mind, a transformation in how our society pursues environmental protection. We're shifting from a model that Carol and I were both part of, where the government not only sets the standards, but does a lot of the technology innovation. Thousands of people figuring out what piece of equipment to bolt on smokestacks, to a world with economic incentives, as Carol is suggesting, where people pay for the harms they're causing. And as a result, everyone thinks about how to be smarter about this. And businesses that step out in front and develop these technologies will succeed. And frankly, those, as Carol has said, who don't step up, don't understand this new world, risk falling by the wayside. And it's not just regulation. It's also pressures from nature. You know, some companies, if you run a ski business, you'd better worry about climate change no matter what the government says. If you're Coca-Cola and you need water for your product, you better worry about these issues no matter what the government says. And frankly, beyond that, there are stakeholders who just want to know now. Lots of stakeholders, not only regulators, not only environmental NGOs. Employees want to work for companies that are doing the right thing. Customers are asking questions. There's never been a bigger impact than when Walmart says to its 10,000 suppliers, step up on these green issues. So I think there is a revolution in business. I think we should celebrate it, because the shift of primary responsibility for innovation and technology development onto the private sector is a great thing. We should celebrate it. The private sector is better than government at technology development, better at risk-taking, better at rewarding success. And frankly, what a joy to see some of America's greatest capitalists here thinking hard about how to solve our problems. When John Doerr is stepping up and Vinod Khosla is stepping up to these issues, it tells me we have had a revolution.
Tom Lovejoy, you've been around in the discussion of biodiversity, sustainable development for a long time. It seems to me that once we start to move into the policy debate regarding what the cost is going to be, what are going to be the economic drivers, what's the regulatory environment going to be like, we seem to lose sight of the environmental goal that may have caused us to be there. That is, what is the concentration level that we have to reach in order to keep the planet stable? Is the debate or the discussion now different than it was 10, 15 years ago?
Well, there's no question that the discussion and the debate is different. It is yet to actually truly focus on where we should stop in terms of greenhouse gas concentrations and climate change. And I think that's the most dangerous part about where we are at the moment, because anybody who really looks at it closely knows that we need to stop, you know, well shy of double pre-industrial, and actually quite a way short of that. But I think, you know, I think what's interesting about this is we're looking at something that's planetary in scale. The only other time we really were doing that was with the CFCs. And that happily was a relatively simple problem with what turned out to be a simple solution. This goes at the very heart of sort of the energy base and the way we manage actually living carbon like tropical forests. And what we need to do is actually think about it in a larger framework, not lose sight of the fact that there will be enormous costs if we don't take this on. So up at Maroon Bells this morning, Bruce Babbitt gave just a wonderful example of the state of Louisiana, and that carries over to the rest of the Gulf Coast, where, you know, half of the citizens of Louisiana live below 3 feet above sea level, you know, which we're going to see. So there's going to be a whole managed retreat of 2 million people inland. That there's a lot of cost in that. There's also opportunity in that. And I, for one, in looking at the really big question, you know, we tend to look at all of this within standard economics and discount rates and all the rest. You know, and the wild question that I'd throw out here, and I don't know the answer to it, but when you're dealing with a problem that's planetary in scale, do the standard way of applying discount rates, does that really apply? So.
John Fund, Tom points out a question that was raised when the Stern report was released, and I think there was a little bit of debate when Stern came to Princeton with Mr. Nordhaus. My read of it was that Nordhaus won the economic argument regarding discount rates and whether it's cheaper now to address climate change with technology and a regulatory system or a tax, or to wait in the future where the technology and the cost will actually be lower. But maybe Stern won the moral debate about wanting and needing to start that now. These are real costs. I think everyone on the panel has acknowledged that there's a need here to address the costs. Is it resting on a premise of accepting the science now, or is there another factor?
Well, I'm happy to admit I'm not a scientific expert on global warming. What I have done a lot of writing about is economic development, especially in developing nations. And the panel today is, can we stop global warming without stopping the global economy? Well, the global economy includes about 1 billion people who live in dire poverty. These are people, 1 out of 7 children in that group die before the age of 5. Africa is replete with examples of horrible poverty. 1.6 billion people around the world have never flicked a light switch, ever. 2.8 billion people still primarily burn wood or other biodegradable entities for fuel. That creates dung lung. 3 million people a year die from that. Arthur Mutambara, the leading opposition figure from Zimbabwe, whom I see in the audience, tells me that in Zimbabwe, the average life expectancy is 35 years of age. 35. It's about half of the people in this room, less. So there are an awful lot of people for whom this is a real pressing question. It's not about our economy. It's not about whether we have to choose. It's their choices and what things will be available to them in the future. And I think that we really have to put them front and center because, for one thing, look around you. How many people are here representing rural China? How many people are here representing rural India? How many people are here representing Africa? Not many. We need to hear their voices. And the thing that I will just conclude with is there are two conflicts of visions that I see in this conference. One is an optimistic one, and I think Richard Branson in part reflected that when he said he was putting up a $25 million prize for alternative energy solutions. The Copenhagen Consensus, which was a group of Nobel Prize winning economists, which ranked all of the problems of the world affecting life and health, and it said there are many things we could do right away. Cure malaria, potable drinking water. And on global warming, they said that top-down economic management, as some people on this panel have said, probably isn't the solution. We need more private investment. And they proposed that every industrialized nation in the world devote 0.05% of GDP towards R&D for non-carbon emitting technology. That would be $25 billion. That's an enormous amount, and it's 1/7 the cost of the Kyoto Protocol. And I would just point out to you, almost none of the nations that signed the Kyoto Protocol have been able to meet its targets. And please understand, all of these other countries that you hope will sign on to things like the Kyoto Protocol, you have to assume they'll honor their agreement. All of these other countries like India and China and Russia, which is about to double its share of coal production in the next 20 years, all of these countries have to participate in this. And I will just end by saying, we've seen in Europe what they've been able to do with the taxes that people want to put on carbon. Gas taxes are higher in Europe than they are in the US, about double. The price of gasoline in Europe is about double what it is. They have tried very, very hard for energy efficiency. I'll just point out to you, though, that since 1990, when the Kyoto benchmark was set, European Union transport sector emissions of carbon, CO2, were 26% higher. In other words, they've doubled the gasoline taxes, they have smaller cars, they have tried very hard to put on what's effectively $200, $300 per ton of CO2 taxes, and their emissions are up 26%. So let's understand, as much as we want to improve the planet, and as much as we want to preserve our economy here in the US, there are other factors involved. We have to find a way to really secure the cooperation of these other countries. Because remember, in China, a coal-fired plant is being opened every week to 10 days. We have to find a way to secure their cooperation. We have to make sure that they don't cheat. And we have to make sure we don't forget what Paul Collier in his latest book called the bottom billion, the billion people of the world who have access to nothing, nothing that we take for granted, including potable water, and including electricity. They are also part of this global economy that we have to care about.
Andy Revkin, last night Tom Friedman did point out that whether or not this green bubble exists and whether or not there is a green revolution happening, he doesn't think it's started yet. It's reached Main Street, but it hasn't gone down Main Street, I think was his phrasing. He pointed out, he made a contrast between the IT revolution and this so-called green revolution, but he pointed out that then the IT revolution was really about technology and the markets. But he says the green revolution can't take place without a third element being government. You've written a lot about these technologies, and you've also written a lot about the science. What's your opinion?
Well, everyone forgets that the IT revolution is based on the microchip, which is based on integrated circuits, which were the result of government research, not the private sector. We've done a series of stories this past 2 years called The Energy Challenge, and I have another piece coming this weekend on solar, sort of the luster of solar versus the real world realities of the limits that existing technologies, those panels you see on roofs that look so cool, are incredibly inefficient and costly still, and will not blunt our coal appetite meaningfully at the level of the technology. Even you'd have to have a factor of 10 or improvement in the technology to start to get close to making it something real, you know, a big chunk of a prospect of our energy pie. So the bottom line really is, I guess Tom's been reading our stories, Friedman, which is good. You know, when the people on the opinion side read the news stories, that's a good sign. I couldn't agree more that, but actually I disagree with him on that the IT revolution was a private sector thing. It was built on public sector basic research, much from the military sector and the space sector originally. Solar panels came out of the space program. They were invented 50 years ago by Bell Labs, and they've been sort of dormant. The technology has lain at a dormant level of quality. You have the steady improvement driven by market forces. Germany has this huge multi-billion dollar price guarantees that they give that have generated an explosively growing industry. But it's explosively growing from being, what is it, 0.01% of the total energy pie? So you can grow that for 40% a year. I think Vinod Kushla, I think you're quoted in this weekend's story as saying that you could have, this growth is great, it's gonna make a lot of millionaires, billionaires even. There's a billionaire in China already from solar cell manufacturer, but it will not blunt the carbon problem. The atmosphere will not notice it without some significant breakthroughs. And no one in the private sector is investing significant capital in the long-term breakthrough. The really big play here is something that would take 10 or 20 years to come about, not on the time scale that venture capitalists are interested in. There's some hard realities in all of this.
John, I want to try to crack this nut because I think that this discussion turns on itself constantly in terms of the environment and the economy, but it also turns upon U.S. leadership or U.S. involvement and the rest of the world. And I think you said earlier that whatever we do to address global warming, it's contingent on all actors globally being a part of that solution, and that no one can really evade agreement or responsibility. Is it going to be a differentiated set of responsibilities, or is the U.S. and the EU and China going to have to take on a leadership position?
Everyone is going to have to take on a leadership position if you believe what you're hearing at this conference, that the reduction in emissions is going to have to be far greater than you can possibly imagine. John Doerr yesterday said we have to take it down to half of today's levels. I just heard Tom say we're going to have to be well shy of double pre-industrial levels. You have no idea how much of a reduction that is. I mean, we are talking about dramatic changes. Now, obviously any incremental step is an improvement, but if you're talking about that kind of dramatic change, I have to tell you, very honestly, the U.S. is not doing a bad job in terms of ramping up R&D, government research. We can do better. But the real actors here are the expanding economies of China, India, Russia. Russia, as I said, has real, real plans for its coal-generated sector, doubling its share by 2020. You have to sit down with Vladimir Putin. You have to sit down with the Politburo of China. You have to sit down with India's leaders. If you don't bring them along, and believe me, we heard from John Doerr yesterday what the response was from the mayor of Dainan, China, about the West lecturing them about their emissions. Why should we listen to you when you're so profligate and stupid in your policies? Well, he has a point. 7,000 bottles of these water containers were consumed at this conference. They're imported from Fiji, for gosh sakes. I'm from San Francisco, and I have to tell you, I normally don't agree with Gavin Newsom, the mayor of San Francisco, but he has finally banned bottled water from his government offices because he says the San Francisco drinking water is just fine. I've tried the Aspen drinking water. It's fine. Why are we importing water from Fiji? 7,000 bottles. Come on, they do have a point. But we have a point about them. They're the ones who are trying to grow and bring their people out of poverty. We have to convince them that these programs to reduce the emissions to half of today's levels are going to have something for them in the future. Otherwise, they're condemning their own people to poverty and deprivation.
Dan, you have your smile?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that having been the chief climate change negotiator at the EPA during the Framework Convention of 92, I think a mistake was made then, repeated in the Kyoto Protocol, that we need to fix. And it was allowing the developing world not to sign on to real targets and timetables. The history of international environmental cooperation has only one model of success, and it's based on a very clear principle of common but differentiated responsibility. Common meaning everyone steps up to something, everyone commits to some standard. Differentiated means it varies depending on whether you're the U.S. and Europe, where you're going to cut emissions a lot, or you're China, where you're going to limit the growth. And I do believe India and China can be brought along and brought into an agreement where they do sign up to limit growth from what would have been 50% to 30% over the next 10 years, let's say. And I think it's going to take some very strong incentives. John's absolutely right. It's going to take some real commitment of resources on our side, and it's going to take U.S. leadership. The other thing I will tell you, having been in government and now having taught for a dozen years at Yale and thought about this a lot, there are no examples of success where the U.S. doesn't step up and lead. And that is a tragedy of the last number of years. We really haven't had that kind of leadership, and I think we must have it going forward. But I do think there are ways to bring China and India on board. And again, I will tell you, the models we have, Carol mentioned CFCs, it was a package of carrots and sticks. It was inducements with offers of subsidy to move to substitutes, technology development help, but also the threat of trade penalties for those that weren't willing to sign on to commitments. And there are those in the trade world who hate this idea, but frankly, uninternalized externalities, which is what all these emissions are, is a worse threat to the global economic situation and to the stability of a market economy across the globe.
You know, it seems like so many things have to happen, though. We're talking about either bilateral or international agreement on a protocol or some other aspect of the convention. You have to have a good grasp on the cost that's going to be associated with this. The New York Times, I'll just read one short paragraph here from the editorial. For all the talk about global warming, leading politicians have yet to educate their constituents and their colleagues about an unpleasant and inescapable truth. Any serious effort to fight warming will require everyone to pay more for energy. According to most scientists, the long-term cost of doing nothing, flooding, famine, drought, would be even higher than the cost of acting now. But unless Americans understand and accept the trade-off, higher prices today to avoid calamity later, the requisite public support for real change is unlikely to build. Andy, is that what are you reading in terms of this balance of interests that have to be solved before we can do anything?
Well, as you were saying before, there are circular elements to this. There's the Alphonse and Gaston aspect of the developing world and the rich countries. We did this series of stories called The Climate Divide. One of the other uncomfortable realities in the long list is that most of the impacts that will be harshest will happen soonest in countries that haven't contributed to the greenhouse problem at all yet. Countries in southern Africa, in coastal areas like Bangladesh, and they're saying, hey, they are definitely saying, hey, what have you done for us lately? And so there you have this incredible standoff. And so I think it was John, someone was saying that you need a suite of initiatives. And I think one thing that's important is to get out of the box of thinking about this as the climate problem. It's an energy problem. The world is going to 9 billion people, all of whom, if they knew it, would probably like to have the comforts and the mobility, the connectedness, the climate control that we have in our houses. and the ability to go somewhere when you want to. They want to use, they would love it. There's never been a person yet I've found who has rejected an energy-laden lifestyle.
I agree with what Andy just said. It's also, it's a fairness issue, which I think sort of goes to John's point, which is, the people who will be most affected in the short term will tend to be the poor, the less fortunate. And where I come in this circle, because there are these sort of do loops you can get into on this issue, is the need for U.S.-American leadership. And that means we have to go ahead and make some decisions, set some targets. You know, the idea that we're going to get there through voluntary efforts by the business community, which I applaud. I absolutely applaud every single thing any company is doing, from Walmart to GE, and the list goes on, and it gets longer every day. But without some clear commitment, enforceable level that we can drive towards, I don't think the voluntary efforts are going to be good enough. I don't think even if we were to invest the kind of money that people are talking about in terms of research, we need to inform that research, inform that investment towards some type of target. Now, what you're going to see occurring in Washington in the next year is a serious debate about what that number should be, what sectors of our economy should be caught up in that scheme, and then what we should do if the impact to our economy reaches a certain point. Some are suggesting what are called off-ramps. I actually call them loopholes. I think that is a big problem. If you say to the economy, yes, we're going to do something, but don't worry, if it gets too hard, we're going to back up and we're not going to do it. You're not going to get the kind of commitment, the kind of leadership, the kind of investment to get us to that number if there's a loophole that's sort of hung out there in the future. And, it doesn't solve all of the problems, John, by any means that you've raised, but it certainly puts the U.S. in a very different position, particularly in the next administration. Obviously, I'm a Democrat. I served in a Democratic administration. But trust me, I don't care who's in the White House. This is going to be on their international list of things to do.
You know, it often surprises people, since I work for the Wall Street Journal, that I often have a very dark view of parts of corporate America. I think they are profit-seeking, some of them are truly greedy, and they will look out for any advantage, and they are very skilled at turning any opportunity to their benefit. Be very careful about something that was, I think, hinted at by Dwight Eisenhower when he warned America about the military-industrial complex, and he had a point. Be very wary as you form and watch this emerging environmental industrial complex. It doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of good things that are going to come of it, but look at this with completely open eyes. The National Journal, which is published by The Atlantic, their cover story today is all about business has decided to go green. They are almost could have read your book, and they are going to pile on to this issue in a big way. But the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, filled with companies like Duke Energy, Alcoa, they do have an agenda, and it's not just for the benefit of the planet. The single most influential corporate lobbyist for Kyoto was Enron. I'm not kidding. They were a natural gas distributor. They wanted to kill coal-fired electric generation, boosting demand for Enron's product. An internal Enron memo, and we now have all of their memos because they collapsed and everybody went to jail and everybody was turning everybody else in and giving them their emails. The internal Enron memo enthused that Kyoto would, quote, do more to promote Enron's business than almost any other regulatory initiative outside of restructuring the energy and natural gas industries in Europe and the United States, unquote. So, as you discover all of these allies in protecting the planet, welcome them. But remember what Reagan said about the Soviet Union. Trust but verify, and understand that there in this emerging environmental industrial complex will be an awful lot of players who want to take you to the cleaners.
I want to let the panelists respond, but I also want to...
Can I respond?
Yeah, I just want to also prepare you. If you have questions, feel free to start queuing up at the mic.
Just a quick response, because I agree with what you just said, which is, inevitably there will be good actors and there will be bad actors. And that's where I think government comes in. And some will be both, but that's where government has a role to play, because it can level the playing field, and it can say to those who are good, here are some rewards, and it can say to those who are bad, we're going to pull you up, and we're going to enforce against you for failure to comply.
Okay, just 5 seconds. Just remember about the government actors. Some of them like power.
Are good, and some of them are bad.
Some of them like power. Some of them like to direct the economy because they see the private sector economy as being outside of their control, and they like to micromanage it. And just remember, you know, remember the famous phrase, beware of people who come to you and say, I'm from the government, I'm here to help you.
Dan, I know you're trying to get a word in.
So let's just notice a couple of things. First of all, just for the sake of history, when I was in the government, I tried to get Ken Lay to support the 1992 Framework Convention on Climate Change. He wouldn't do it. So people have to be brought around. And I do think that's what's going on now. More and more people are starting to understand this issue. And it took, you know, 10 more years for the Enron folks to figure out this was to their advantage. So I don't think that's bad. Mixed motives are nothing new in Washington. That people have a profit motive and are going to help the planet is a good thing, not a bad thing. So let's structure the incentives in ways that draw people in, engage them in the search for solutions, and frankly reward those who do well. But I don't think we disagree. I think what we all are saying here is that we need a sharp framework of incentives with clear price on carbon emissions, making people pay for the harms they cause at every scale, corporate scale down to the household scale. And I think that will get us where we need to go. And frankly, just to pick on something Andy said, there's a ton of money, tens of billions of dollars being poured into innovation for energy efficiency, for alternative energy, for capturing of carbon, the whole clean tech sweep of activities. And why are people doing it? They're doing it in anticipation of real regulation because they do believe that there's going to be a price to carbon coming in the next couple of years. Those that are operating in Europe have it already, and I think the odds are that we will have it. But one last point in terms of how we address the point of the panel today, how do we make it not economically burdensome? One of the other things that I have come to realize, having sat out of Washington for a decade, is that we often try to solve problems overnight. This one we should solve by not an off-ramp strategy, but a ramp-up strategy. Let's impose the carbon fees at a low level and move it up every year or two for 20 years so that people can write off capital that was invested on old models of the energy economy and move into these new approaches and really incentivize people to think about how to invest going forward in ways that are very different. Let's have it a clear price. Let's have no backing off from it. But we don't need to have it happen overnight.
Tom, do we have time to nurse the economy through this debate and until it arrives at some set of solutions or some type of dynamic that allows the economy and the environment to come together? Or really, has the prospect for change, is it already out of reach?
Part of the answer to that depends on what you mean by time to nurse. What one really has to face the fact is that we've already passed some tipping points in the climate system and the natural systems of the planet. The issue here is avoiding tipping a lot more. And so far, most of them have been relatively gentle, and it would be nice to restrict ourselves to that kind of experience. I personally think this is all much more immediate and urgent than most people get. And it is deeply complicated, as we've been hearing. And the one thing I would like to add is there's one other player in the game, or potentially in the game, which might have an important role to play, and that's the World Bank. I mean, here's an institution that, to a certain extent, has outlived some of the original circumstances for which it was formed. It no longer has the dominant role it used to have because of the growth of the private sector and other regional development banks. But this could turn out to be the bank's greatest role in its entire history. If it is willing to take on, A, the issue of the bottom billion, which is so real and, you know, will suffer the most from climate change, but B, if they can come up with a series of innovative ways to encourage, you know, the Chinas and the Indias to move in the right direction on energy. And I know there's actually, at the moment, it's only sort of playing around the margin of all of that. But there is a thought that's just hatched inside the bank in the last couple of weeks, which could actually be a very useful new addition.
Since Senator Hart made this point just the other day in saying that if we're going to have any kind of global or multinational solutions, that we will need new institutional arrangements or new institutions, and in fact that we need to be looking at a new internationalism. Of course, it's very unpopular, as is Tom Friedman's idea of government involvement in trying to set the price here.
Which is why the bank might be a good way to go, because it already exists.
Atam Tambara from Zimbabwe. I think there's an operative phrase that we need to embrace, which is interconnectedness of global challenges. What are the global challenges? Climate change, abject poverty, HIV/AIDS, human rights, terrorism, nuclear weapons. All these global challenges are interconnected. You can't resolve the issues around climate change without addressing HIV/AIDS, without addressing poverty. So it is very important that we seek global solutions and not national solutions, because you can't save the globe for America. A starving peasant in Darfur cannot have a green agenda. So my question to you is, in the different frameworks you've been providing, do we have evidence of holistic and unified approaches that leverage the notion of interconnectedness of global challenges?
Yeah, Andy? Well, this came up recently when we were doing the climate divide stories, this package, which is all online, easy to find, Google Climate Divide. One of the things that's happening already is this effort, somewhat within the development banks, to start to, when they have a project, if it's a highway project, or if it's a school building project or whatever, they're very slowly starting to say, what are the energy aspects to that? Or if we're going to build a road in a place where there's flooding, we better damn well make sure that we're building a road that is going to last through a flood, that kind of thing. And the problem is, in a lot of developing countries, they don't have the capacity to get the transport minister, the environment minister, in the same room and thinking the same way. And so there's a lot of capacity building that has to happen here, too. There's a lot, whatever we do, even including through the banks, would have to involve getting on the ground with people in countries and helping them enable them so that they're when they're developing, they're thinking about this multifaceted aspect of things from the get-go.
And everyone wants to respond to you. John, I'll go John and Dan and then Carol.
In looking at a holistic solution, I think we also have to look backwards as well as forwards. In the last 100 years, as Tom mentioned, we certainly have seen some global warming. And he believes that we've reached certain tipping points. I might demur. But we have seen global warming, 0.7 of a degree. We've also seen in the last 100 years global GDP go up 1,800%, life expectancy double. Now, let's assume, and I don't believe this is the case, that all of the increase in global warming was due to man's economic activity. And very few people believe that. Let's also assume that there were only economic harms and no benefits. Most people don't believe that. They believe that it's at least there's some benefits in some regions of the world. Would anyone here, in order to achieve John Doerr's goal of today reducing emissions by half, would anyone want to go back over the last 100 years and cut that economic growth in half? That economic growth enabled us to become wealthy enough to clean up many of the industrialized worlds, which were environmental snake pits. I mean, I remember when Lake Erie could catch on fire. Economic growth can lead to innovation. It can provide the money and the capital investment, which can help you improve the environment. So while government will play a role, and I certainly believe it should, my preference would be it should be along the lines of the Nobel scientists and the Copenhagen Consensus, where we encourage more R&D spending. We have commitments to R&D spending for non-carbon emitting technologies, but I can agree there are other approaches. Let's not forget, the history of the last 100 years is the history of economic growth. And while we had global warming, we also developed the capital, which enables us to have this very pleasant conversation about how we're going to deal with the problem. If we reduce global economic growth too much in order to achieve the targets that John Doerr mentions, half of emissions today, or the emission reductions that Tom Lovejoy is talking about, we may be giving up the baby with the bathwater.
Dan, that still seems like the either-or kind of choice.
I want to have a rare opportunity here for someone from the Yale Environment School to attack the Wall Street Journal as too left-wing.
I'm not right or left-wing. I'm a radical.
The idea of a big fund that governments manage to invest in these new technologies.
We can have tax credits.
All right, but the fund is a crazy idea. This is the old industrial...
I didn't support it.
The old industrial strategy kind of stuff, and governments don't do a good job picking winners. If we want integration, and that was our speaker's question, the single best way to get integration is a price signal. Then whatever you're doing, you have to think about it. If you're in transportation, if you're making cars, you think about how to reduce the energy consumption because there's a price to be paid for causing the harm. So if we want that, we go back to thinking, I believe, we want strong economic incentives. I, like Carol, like the idea of a carbon tax. Country by country, this can be used to develop in ways that that country chooses. So in Africa, it could be invested in health, in education, in economic development, of building businesses. In our country, we might roll down other taxes in order to promote economic growth. I personally would love to see the payroll taxes brought down. I would support a carbon tax and a revenue-neutral approach that drives down payroll taxes and or promotes incentives for investments in risky businesses that otherwise might not get them. So I think we can do this in a way that's integrated and pro-economic growth.
Carol, can we realign tax incentives? I mean, for 15 years on the environment, that's a question that you've marched up to Capitol Hill to address.
Well, it is, Dan and I, all being from different administrations, I absolutely agree on this, that at the end of the day, the fairest, the simplest, and it will not be simple, but certainly more simple than a cap and trade, is some sort of taxing mechanism, and you do something with the payroll tax, without a doubt, to address whatever sort of inequalities get created. The problem we have is taxes are really hard for Washington. They're hard for state governments. They're really hard in Washington. And so, there's a way in which a cap and trade program where you set a cap and then you allow companies that emit above the cap to buy credits. Companies who are below can sell those credits. So you create a trading regime is not dissimilar from a tax program. The danger I see in setting up a cap and trade program is that Congress will get into picking which sectors are in and out of the program, and I think that the economic consequences of that could be very troubling. But the interconnectedness, I think that's a very good point you raise, and I think one of the things that we attempted to do after Dan left and the Clinton-Gore administration took over the Kyoto process was through things like joint implementation and the Clean Development Mechanism, which are programs within the Kyoto process, to create opportunities where developed countries would make investments in developing countries as they sought to grow their energy sources. I personally don't think it has worked out to the degree that all of us envisioned. It has been a lot about China, and I don't know that China needs a lot of U.S. investment in terms of growing their energy or cleaning up their greenhouse gas emissions. But we shouldn't throw that idea out. The idea that developed nations could work with developing nations, I think, is one that needs to be revisited in terms of how we go about doing it, to think about these issues and to think about the issues not just around climate change, but all of the other issues that are important to the developing countries.
Let's go to the next question.
Thank you. My name is Friso van Orange. I'm from Europe. I think one of the biggest challenges is going to be information. And just to take one aspect that was discussed in this panel, was the European gas tax. There is no European gas tax. The gas prices were always 3-4 times as high as the gas prices in Europe. These were taxes that we used to pay for our welfare system. Right. Now people are turning around and saying this is a gas tax. It isn't. It's having no impact on the environment. The money is not being spent on cleaning the environment. And if Europe gets away by people in America saying that we're doing a good job, that's really not the right way forward. I think, just another example on the other side, you said our transportation CO2 has gone up by 26%. It's true, you can also look at Denmark, which has grown over the last, 5 years at 2-3% without increasing CO2. Obviously, transportation is difficult, but in other sectors, whether it's in housing, they've managed to offset that. So how are we gonna deal with this aspect of misinformation? Because that's gonna be a big source of disappointment, I think, for people. And to speak in the words of Friedman, we might create the impression that we're going down Main Street, but really, as Europe, we're really not there.
So the question is, how are we going to deal with the misinformation or the contrasted and conflicting stories about it?
I did not say that the European gas taxes went to the environment. They certainly go into the general fund. I simply made the point that many people here supported higher gas taxes in the U.S. as a means of controlling carbon emissions. Gas taxes in Europe have been double or even triple, depending on the country, for decades. And they haven't had that effect. 11 of the 15 original co-signers in Europe of the Kyoto protocols are going to vastly exceed the targets. Denmark has an honest bureaucracy, has a commitment to keeping international agreements, and I commend Denmark for what it's been able to do. I will simply tell you that Europe is a very diverse place, and a leading French politician told me that one of the best ways we have of achieving competitive advantage with the U.S. is to enter into agreements that none of us ever intend to honor. He told me that off the record. And if you don't believe the French are capable of it, go back over the history of French diplomacy. And I will tell you, be very careful about taking the fine example of Denmark and believing that you can automatically extend it all over Europe.
Andy, you want to respond to this?
Yeah, well, I think the big point that might be missed a little bit in the Euro bashing, whatever that is.
No, just French bashing.
No, French bashing, okay. Now, the really big point here is that there's a lot that consumers seem very willing to tolerate a lot of flex and energy prices and not change behaviors.
Yes.
Most of the economists that I've talked to in doing this energy challenge series, there was a story I did last October where a lot of them say simply an energy tax or a cap, whatever you want to call it, whatever mechanism you use, that's politically tenable will not meaningfully change climate emissions. So,
exactly.
And one that, the one that could change climate emissions would have to be very sharp, not very sharp, but very profoundly guaranteed to rise,
right.
To rise relentlessly into the future. And we're really bad at that stuff. I mean, the national park system, I think, is the only thing that's sort of sacrosanct.
Because one Congress can't bind the next Congress.
Right.
Well, but what's so important about is for the business community to make the adjustments, to make the investments, they have to see where that's headed. And if we only do it in 2 or 3 year increments, they're not going to make the kind of broad-scale changes that need to be made.
So how do you build that into the Washington process? How do you build in that guarantee? And actually, even within the framework, the Kyoto Treaty, let's poll the panel. Who thinks there will be a broader, bigger set of carbon restrictions in whatever comes after Kyoto? And I mean restrictions, mandates.
Well,
yeah, it has to be.
So let's do it quickly. Who says
do.
Yes?
I do.
So let me, though, can I jump back?
Okay. Alone, I don't know.
Can I jump back to the question, though, because I think there was an important piece of it that we might want to spend a minute or two on, and that is that there is an information age opportunity here. We have technologies that allow us now to be much more refined in how we signal people about what behavior should be rewarded and what behavior should be penalized because it's harm-causing. And I think one of the things we should do is not tax gasoline because people don't see that as a harm-causing activity. We should tax emissions coming out of the tailpipe. So why not, with your utility bill at the end of the month, a tailpipe emissions bill? It's easy to put a sensor in those tailpipes now, rack up the dollars that are being emitted, and send people a bill at the end of the month.
And what member of Congress has introduced this bill?
Well, you know, there's a political question that we can get to. But let's also say, if this is a time where we need fresh thinking, let's explore it. Let's try to talk about it. You could roll down other taxes. And why not simpler things? You could put the electric meter, rather than the basement or outside, in the kitchen. So people see the electricity. They can figure out which things are going on. There are lots of smart meter opportunities to have the air conditioning
California,
turned up
40% of California smart meter, and
smart.
I have faith.
So let's, before getting too quick about the political difficulty here, let's acknowledge there's a huge information age potential to marry digital technology to environmental challenges of all sorts, but particularly energy efficiency, and let's bring it on with price signals that reward that.
To go to Andy's point, though, I think this is a very, and I apologize, question about, how do you get Congress to sort of make the commitment and then hold to it, election after election after election? And I think it's a very, very good question. It's difficult to do. The interesting thing that happens around a lot of tax decisions is that there are people who benefit from these tax decisions who become lobbyists, if you will, to maintain them. And so you end up with a whole group of actors in the
environmental industrial complex,
insiders who benefit. It may not be a bad thing.
Well, if the environmental industrial complex could replace the military industrial complex or the
we could just have some
health
money.
Industrial complex, maybe it wouldn't be a bad thing. Your question.
Hi, my name is Kelsey Lin, and I'm from Stanford and Google. And I definitely hear what you're saying about the need for regulation and policy. But in the meantime, a lot of large corporations are stepping up and committing to carbon neutrality through, among other ways, carbon offsets. And I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to what you think the effectiveness of carbon offsets in setting up a carbon market and who you see stepping up to regulate carbon offsets.
It's a good question, and I want to help frame it a little more here because
There's been a couple of articles talking about offsets as something that the affluent can do to kind of pad their guilt, if you will, for their lavish lifestyles, or that it may not actually be real. I think there's a lot of doubting about whether it is. I will say that the carbon associated with this conference and the water has been offset.
You mean the transportation for the water?
And the carbon that went into producing it.
I don't want to get into a debate.
No, seriously.
I always have one question for the carbon offset companies. You know, we have a lot of debate now about hedge funds and how unregulated they are, non-transparent, even though they're engaged in one-third of the market transactions in the stock market. Well, you know, I actually favor more transparency for hedge funds. I think they've gotten big enough, we need that. But let me tell you, these carbon offset companies, I would love an independent audit of all of these.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
before you invest in your carbon offset,
I would have
this conference conduct an independent audit to see if this was really offset.
Well, this is a good point. I want to have the panel address this, because the verification and the certification and whether there's an industry for that is a part of whether that industry can be legitimate. And in fact, some environmental groups are this attestation for that now, rather than third party independent verification.
Just really quickly, nothing will ever be better than a direct reduction than your emissions. Offsetting is, you know, second, third, or fourth best. Absolutely needs to be verified. I mean, I think we're going to find out that there's lots of, I don't want to say sham operators out there, but, and I also think it's important to understand what is the offset you're buying. You know, these offsets have lives to them, and, you know, at some point, a forest, for example, may be an offset today, but it's not an offset in the future. It actually contributes to carbon emissions. So I would be very, very suspicious and leery and do my homework very, very well.
Tom?
I totally agree that the devil is in the details on this. But A, you know, as far as the atmosphere is concerned, a molecule of CO2 is a molecule of CO2. So whether it goes up or down is the issue. Second point, and we really haven't touched on that at all here, is that currently about 23% of the annual CO2 increase in the atmosphere comes from the destruction of tropical forests for a whole variety of reasons. If there is some offsetting mechanism in which there is a financial return to people responsible for those forests so that it becomes in their interest to protect them, that's good for the atmosphere and it's certainly a good offset.
Tom, I couldn't agree with you more. The destruction of the tropical forests is a worldwide catastrophe. But just remember, 2.8 billion people rely on their heat and their cooking from wood and other biodegradable products. They're cutting down that in order to have their lifestyle, which is a pretty wretched one. Economic growth, sustainable economic growth, like what we've had over the last 100 years that have brought millions, hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, can reduce the need to cut down those trees.
Well, but that's,
I don't think there's any disagreement
about that.
I don't want to have
it depends
a false
how you do
debate
it.
Here, but Dan, I know Dan wanted to respond to this.
On the issue of the offsets, I think those can be the tail, not the dog, of a corporate strategy. You need to have real effort to reduce emissions, real effort internally for energy efficiency and to make sure you're doing everything you can. And frankly, you need to be committing to technology innovation as well so the long-term problems are being resolved. And then, oh, by the way, as an interim measure, offsetting your emissions is not a bad thing to do. But I think you really do want it to be part of a more broad program. And frankly, those that are not doing the homework to really check their offsets are doing a disservice. Because as several people have mentioned, there are some carbon cowboys out there who are doing some crazy things, frankly, in China, where 60 to 70% of all offsets have been done. And frankly, the European Union structure, the carbon market that's been set up there, was not sufficiently verified and audited. And you've got people doing things like replacing boilers in China. And you go in and see the new boiler. Oh, that looks good. It's taken down emissions that were there a good bit. But then out behind the factory is the old boiler set up again. So, you know, and now you have the new and the old. That's totally unacceptable. And we really should be investing in monitoring, measuring, verifying, and auditing, because markets don't work without that kind of certainty that what is being shown to the world is real.
And if you can only get the cooperation of the Communist Party of China to have this kind of intense monitoring you're going to need, life will be wonderful.
Andy, did you make a point here?
Well, I just wanted to make the point about economic growth. Tom would probably know the data on this, but I guarantee you that the soy explosion in the Amazon and China's amazing hunger for tropical timber to build products to sell to us are a much bigger influence overall on forest loss right now than is rural firewood biomass burning.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about that is China's appetite for soy is largely water-driven, because water is such a scarce commodity in China, and all their rivers, you know, have their headwaters up in Tibet, and they're already feeling the impact of climate change.
I want to try to get through as many questions as we can.
Okay, just short question, is there any organization you see stepping up to do this verification that you stress?
I did a piece in the Week in Review section weekly recently that had a couple of names. I don't remember them right now.
Yeah, there are. I mean, to damn the mark is because we don't trust them initially in this emerging area is kind of really counter-capitalist. I don't really understand that.
Hi, Emily Olin with Booz Allen. In the vein of the earlier water bottle comment, as well as China's deforestation to build products to sell back to us, I've heard a lot of discussion all week about technological advances and increasing energy efficiency as solutions, which are obviously all very critical. But for a problem that we're here calling global in scale, for a problem that we're saying requires dramatic decreases on the scale of half, what do you guys see as the, you know, are technological solutions enough, and what is the significance of our personal responsibilities and behaviors as consumers in the developed world?
Andy?
Well, again, the people I talked to, there have been a lot of sort of false dichotomies set up in the last hour or so, and just in the general discourse, it's filled with them. It's a catastrophe, it's a hoax. That's the biggest dichotomy, and of course, the reality is in the middle. The bottom line is it's an all-of-the-above problem. The energy problem, underlying the climate problem, underlying the poverty problem, is probably the single problem that is most important to deal with in the next generation or two on this planet. Richard Smalley, the dear departed Nobel Prize winning chemist who went on this evangelist tour of America before he died a couple years ago of leukemia, he said that if you look at the 21st century, you look at the 10 top problems, you know, education, poor health in Africa, whatever, they all relate. You could ameliorate all of them with energy advances. And that's the kind of thing that I think can cut through this the discourse of it's this or that. And that requires, most economists say, that it requires some kind of restriction on emissions, that, you know, the bad stuff that has this long-term cost has to be priced. But that's not enough either. You need a research, an aggressive, sustained, focused on research as well. It's not an either-or problem. And that's where there has no, and there's no lobbyist for that. There's no lobbyist for basic research. There's big lobbyists for farm state biofuels. There's big lobbyists for the national labs doing nuclear, like fish fusion stuff. But there's no one out there for
panels. Carolyn,
I think somewhere embedded in your question was actually sort of public education. How do you educate people so that they can embrace a set of changes? I want to use this water as an example. For 8 years, I was responsible for setting drinking water standards for the people of this country. This water is probably not tested. The water that comes out of your tap is tested daily, if not more than once a day. However, when we set a standard for arsenic, when we set a standard for cryptosporidium, the amount of pushback we got, and this was not a partisan issue, the amount of pushback we got from mayors and governors who did not want to charge their constituents another 5 or 10 cents a day for water actually led to my successor stopping the arsenic rule. So as Americans, we are willing to pay. How much is this bottle?
Much more expensive than gasoline.
We are willing to pay more for bottled water that is not tested, because somehow or another we now believe that this is a better product than what comes out of our taps. So I think part of the issue going forward is not just the regulations and the investment in R&D. It is educating people on the realities of what are happening and the choices we can be making.
I mean, I think it seems to be, to me, a little bit more of a cultural aspect of the economy than it is the water choice necessarily.
No, there are lots of people who think bottled water is safer.
We know that. Energy it took to bring that from Fiji.
But let's go back. I do think personal responsibility is a critical element here. And I think that, you know, one of the things we saw in a recent environmental poll we did at Yale was that the American public is recognizing that. And I think perhaps it's because the government has done so little. but we now have 88% of the American public saying part of the climate change solution is people making choices that are the right choices. So I think we are getting that. But I also think we have to recognize, and this is some, again, research we've done at Yale, that most long-term success at scale is about technology development. There are a small number of issues where personal behavioral change drove the outcome. But there's really a lot where you've got to put the technology forward. And I'll just give you one quick example. We looked over in a project a couple of years ago over what had been done in the first generation of environmental policy, basically 1972 to 1990s. What had worked and what hadn't. The single biggest failure was getting people not to drive cars. There were all kinds of policies. Some of you will remember Michael Dukakis, who used curb cuts to control driving and carpool lanes and all these other things, charge for parking. There was a lot of stuff done, total failure. And the data that John presented on Europe, miles driven going up or kilometers driven going up, number of cars going up, why? It turns out people value mobility more than anything else. So if we put success on climate change ahead of these other values, whether it's development of the developing world or mobility in America, we will lose.
And I would suggest that the mobility is part of the water question.
This is a question of having the water convenient in your hand. But
right.
Just one last point on this, because it's really important that as we set out solutions, we don't compete against things that people value more. And when we try to figure out why driving, and driving alone became such a big deal for the American people, we surveyed who was most committed to their car. And some of you may know the answer to this. You know, it's not teenagers. It's mothers with children. They are the ones that care about driving more than anyone else, because you can't do what mothers in our society are expected to do of getting to and from the daycare center by way of the dance studio and home by way of the grocery store on a bus. So if you care about this issue, you've got to have solutions that don't run roughshod against other values in society.
I agree. And Andy made a very good point. Now, there's no lobbyist for basic research. And I think that is a clear failure in both government and the markets. That's why I think Richard Branson's challenge for $25 million for people to come up with alternatives is so important. When somebody put up just a $10 million prize for private travel into space, the prize was won within 3 years. You can do an enormous amount. Aspen is the only place I know on the planet that has its own philanthropy magazine. If people here substituted for this market government failure in basic research and follow Richard Branson's example of putting up prizes for non-carbon trading emission technology, boy, I think we could do a lot.
Let's just try to get two more questions in.
Okay.
Just give them in sequence.
It seems...
And a question, please, because we're out of time.
Yeah, it just seems the most politically realistic thing I've heard is either ramping up carbon tax over the next 20 years or screwing down the cap combination, because the next 20 years is where we're going to see the economic and social costs and all of us experiencing it. When I went down after Katrina, it's more destruction than I'd seen in any war, any of my friends who've covered wars, a million environmental refugees. You know, what's unrealistic today seems very realistic over 20 years because we start seeing the cost in our daily lives.
Yes, good. Absolutely.
But about the rising sea levels, I don't know the answer to this question, but I will pose it. Tony Blair's science advisor, until about 2001, 2002, was at a conference that the Aspen Institute sponsored in Washington in February. He was stumped by the following question. Insurance companies are very, very profit maximizing, and so are people who buy real estate. The price of beachfront property around the world continues to go up dramatically higher than the rate of inflation. Somehow there's a disconnect between people who believe the calamity is upon us and people who are investing with their real dollars and insurance companies that are investing with real premiums.
And that doesn't prove either one.
Some of that is right.
There's also
pesticides. Right.
Let's get one last question in for our audience. Okay?
On the insurance side, it's because all the insurance companies sell most of the risk to the reinsurance companies, and they are worried.
They are worried.
They are worried.
Swiss Re and those guys are
one last question, please.
Quick question.
The broker.
In the last 18 months, global warming, climate change has become a big buzzword, a big story. It's gone from sort of back of the book to radar screen. A lot of it was about whether it was happening, and that's kind of filtered down now to what do we do about it. What do you see as keeping this front and center when there's such a short attention span for these issues? And I think that the issues you've been describing here, it's a little danger preaching to the converted. So what keeps this an issue in the media and to the general public, not to the people in this tent?
I will, in my opinion, people experiencing it are seeing photographs of it. There is no doubt that when the Cuyahoga River caught on fire, it stimulated an environmental movement in this country. There were people out there thinking about it, but the masses started thinking about it. I suspect that that photograph of the polar bear floating on the bit of the iceberg probably moved more people to think about this issue than virtually, well, maybe Al Gore's movie, than virtually anything else. And so, you know, as someone who's tried to create environmental change for most of my adult career, we have to, if we want to do the kind of things, we want our politicians to do the kind of things that are going to need to be done, or what I believe need to be done, we are going to have to constantly give people access to information in ways that they can understand and that they can evaluate in terms of what is happening to them in their life. You know, something going on halfway around the world, something going on 70 or 80 years from now is very, very hard for people to grasp. When we would set a gasoline standard and gasoline prices would go up because of that standard, when we said to people, this is about the air your children breathe, if we set this standard, it will cost you less than a pizza on Friday night. People were for it. And so I think for all of us who think about these issues, telling a story that can captivate and maintain people's attention as the politicians try and make very tough decisions is going to be pretty important.
Andy, very quickly, because we have...
Yeah, I know. I would love to think that this story fits into that template, but I don't think it does. There's been a lot of buzz lately. I've covered this since 1985. And I think we have to, if people, activists, campaigners, and politicians who try to engage the public on this issue aren't honest about the scale and the complexity, then they could lose as much faith in the public as they've gained recently. Because the atmosphere and the climate system and the Arctic and all these things that we've seen lately that seem to be in flux, they have flux in them. There's a lot of natural variability. The same models that are pointing to an ice-free Arctic Ocean later in the century, as I've
all
written.
Right. And on that note...
They say that there could be a lot of... The sea ice could expand and contract between now and then. So if you're thinking polar bears, don't think that we're heading in a unidirectional catastrophe. Think that this is a complex system. It's a multi-generational problem.
All right. I'm going to have to end the panel there. Please join me in thanking our panel. It's been a wonderful discussion. Also... Dan will be available at Pepke to sign his book, as will Andrew will be with his book as well, and Andy Refkin.